Good morning, this is Hugh Follett, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Douglas Crawford Brown, director of the Carolina Environmental Program at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and we're discussing Cass Sunstein's book, Risk and Reason. Douglas, glad to have you on the show.
Thanks very much, Hugh.
I wonder if you could begin by giving a very quick outline of the central argument in Sunstein's book.
I see 6 points here. First, he argues that we should try to minimize human suffering, and he thinks of this within the constraints of available resources. Then he says, in order to do this, we need accurate estimates of risk, and we need to know what the relative risks are from different activities. And then he says, to the extent feasible, we should focus limited resources on the sources of risk that are largest and that are amenable to reduction. He goes from that to say the general public usually isn't very good at estimating these risks, that they're swayed by a number of emotional biases and poor heuristic tools. And therefore, he thinks experts should be relied on rather than the public and political processes to bring a balancing of costs and benefits. And then a regulator should take this into account by having some flexibility in producing different standards for different parts of industry, different sources of risk, and by identifying the winners and the losers.
I'm wondering, I mean, it seems to me I already have some sense of the answer to this. If you can tell me what you see now as this. As the strengths of this book.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of strengths in it. One of it lies in simply being confronted with this topic in a way that makes it understandable to the reader. I went into this reading of the book not being a big proponent of cost-benefit analysis, and partially it's simply because I don't come out of economics. I mean, I come out of physics initially, but partially because I've always sort of viewed cost-benefit analysis as not being antithetical to ethical arguments, but somehow being secondary or off to the side of ethical arguments. And one of the very nice things about this book, even if he doesn't lay it out exactly, is that it causes the reader to think about the issue of cost-benefit analysis in an ethical framework. I mean, he does start with the idea in this book that we do want to reduce human suffering. And if that's our goal, his argument is going to be that the way in which we can get to there is by doing a sort of cost-benefit analysis. So he's not juxtaposing cost-benefit analysis against ethics and morals. He puts it in there as a requirement for reaching some sort of a moral state. So I really liked that aspect of the book. He also does a very good job of laying out the sort of reasons why experts might be better at getting us to this ethically justified state where there's less human suffering. And he doesn't do it just by sort of denigrating the public, denigrating normal reasoning and so forth. He gives the strengths and weaknesses of the general public's reasoning, but then comes down and says, now, here are the tools that the experts use, and these tools have been specifically designed to get us to our goal of protecting the public health. So I think he does a nice job of laying out the philosophical framework in here and sort of disarming some of the concerns that I know I originally had when I thought about cost-benefit analysis. I actually came out of this book leaning more towards cost-benefit analysis than I did going in, not necessarily because of anything particular that I can point to in the book, but because of the way in which he's formulated the whole problem. So I was quite happy with that aspect of the book.
And I take it then that the argument as you laid out at the beginning clearly then on your view has a strong surface plausibility that someone needs to confront whether they're going to agree with him or not.
You know, it's sort of odd. I have to drive back and forth to Washington, D.C. a lot to work with the EPA. And the last time I went up there, maybe 2 times before, I guess, I had just read the book. And I was up by myself in the car, and I'm driving along. And I'm actually arguing with myself about the contentions in the book, trying to defend my original position, which was that we don't need cost-benefit analysis at all, and finding it really difficult when I really probed down into my sort of underlying belief that we don't need cost-benefit analysis. I was finding it difficult, given what I learned from Sunstein, to maintain that sort of perception. So I think he's done a nice job of putting out a plausible argument. I can give counter arguments, but I'm not sure my counter arguments are necessarily better than his argument. So he simply lays out a completely consistent way of thinking about regulatory risk mitigation.
Okay, so it would be fair to say that you think that it's an appealing and interesting idea, and that if there are problems, many of the problems may be in the details about the way he works it out.
Well, they may be in the details, although I'm not sure when we get to weaknesses, for example, I'm not sure I'll say that there are weaknesses here that are rooted in the details. I think the issue that I would raise more is that he gives a perfectly plausible argument, and so as a rhetorical device, it works really well, but that I can create other plausible arguments that don't lead you in that direction. So it's one of these cases where you read the book, there's nothing said in the book that's wrong, and so that makes it sound like a very good argument, but I guess what I'm saying is there are other arguments that don't lead you through cost-benefit analysis that aren't discussed in the book. So there's nothing wrong with his argument, but it's not the only argument that could be given.
Well, maybe that's a good way to begin to talk about what some of the potential misgivings of the book are, or as you might want to describe them instead of that, as some of the alternate ways in which someone might think about the issue of regulating risks.
One of the issues that comes up here is, and you find this often in the general public, is, and with environmental groups, by the way, then the NGOs, is this concern that cost-benefit analysis might be a good tool in the abstract. In other words, it makes sense when you look at it step by step, but that it is a tool which has been captured by certain players in the environmental arena. So it's been captured by industry, it's been captured by economists, and so there's a sort of dis-ease amongst some members of the environmental community that was dis-ease, by the way, not disease, a dis-ease that cost-benefit analysis is hiding a set of assumptions that in the end really don't have any purpose other than to prevent society from regulating some things that it ought to regulate. So there's sort of I would call it a sociological or a political argument here that says cost-benefit analysis sounds okay in the abstract, but it's being misused as a tool, and therefore we should be skeptical of it. Sunstein doesn't really raise that question in this book, but it is a sort of powerful counter-argument to it. The second thing that I would raise with respect to the book is that he doesn't really confront the inability to meet what I would call criteria of minimal epistemic status. This is the idea that it's just wrong to believe something on the basis of insufficient evidence. And cost-benefit analysis often fails to meet that criterion. In other words, we can't estimate the benefits very well. We can't estimate the costs very well. And so we could argue that, well, CBA is a nice tool in the ideal sense, but in reality, it's never going to provide the level of confidence that we need in its predictions. So that's one issue. Now, one of the ways in which cost-benefit analysts often get around that is to just use the expectation value or the average value for benefits and costs and so forth, but that raises a whole set of other questions as to whether people ought to only use the average value of risk. Another weakness or potential shortcoming is he has in here solely a technocratic and objective conception of the risk. He thinks of risk as being something that exists in the world. It's actually a property of the world, and you discover this risk in the same way that you discover the weight of a car. You run it over a scale somewhere and see how much it weighs. And so he thinks of risk as being a property of the world, and if you think of it in that way, then it's natural to think, well, good, then let's get scientists involved and get them to estimate risk, because science is our best way, we might argue, for getting at objective properties of the world. But in the process of doing that, he's left out a couple of other conceptions of risk. There is a subjective conception of risk. Now, he discards that, and I happen to agree with him on that. I'm not sure I want public policy being driven by just how people feel about a situation. And so he doesn't really confront subjectivity straight on, but he does sort of say it's not to be considered further. But there is another idea, which is the psychologistic conception of risk, in which risk is tied up with not only the objective properties of the world, but our limited understanding of that world. So we might say that we risk something because we don't understand it. And that kind of concept of risk just doesn't really have a place in this cost-benefit analysis approach. He also doesn't distinguish why a risk is being, or doesn't distinguish between cases that have different reasons for a risk being imposed. And so I might, for example, talk about risks that are purely natural, like radon, for example, in a radioactive gas. I might talk about risks that are imposed in pursuit of another health goal. For example, disinfection byproducts are produced in drinking water because we're trying to lower the risk from microbes. I might talk about risks that are being produced on society during the pursuit of profit, in which an industry is using a common resource. And in this framework, there doesn't seem to be, or in Sunstein's framework, there doesn't seem to be a difference between those cases. And yet, to me, those are very different cases that might need to be treated quite a bit differently. Now, he also talks about the market as being a great place to deal with these risk issues. I think that presumes the market has some sort of a knowledge that's embodied somewhere, that somewhere in the market this understanding of the risks and the benefits and the costs and so forth are embodied in a particular person or organization making decisions. And I find that to be kind of a stretch here. I think probably the market is much more diffuse than that. So those are some of the things I would put on the side as being potential weaknesses of his argument, but they're weaknesses of the general cost-benefit analysis and the technocratic expert approach to decision-making.
Okay, great. I want to pursue all these in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause just for a moment for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Douglas Crawford Brown, director of the Carolina Environmental Program at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and we're discussing Cass Sunstein's book, Risk and Reason. All right, let's go back and again and look at each of those, maybe some of them a little bit more than others. The first one is that the argument, as you laid out at the beginning, the six steps of the argument at the beginning, looks very compelling, and it looks very compelling, someone might say, because cost-benefit analysis appears to be a good way of protecting people from harm. And again, as you put it, that in the abstract, that looks good, but some people might say in the concrete, it doesn't work out very well, in part because the very notion of a cost-benefit analysis has been somehow taken over by industry and economists, and that skews the way that we understand both costs and benefits. In particular, you talked about there being some sort of hidden set of assumptions. Could you give some examples of what some of these hidden assumptions might be that someone who would criticize the cost-benefit analysis might want to raise against Sunstein?
Well, okay. First, I want to say that I'm not stating that there are in fact these hidden assumptions inside of cost-benefit analyses. What I'm saying is that there are many groups in society who, because they haven't looked down inside the cost-benefit analysis, and because the cost-benefit analysis is consistently coming from industry, from people who are perceived as having some stake in the profit, there's a sort of skepticism about those assumptions. Now, having said that, though, there are some assumptions that lie inside cost-benefit analyses usually that are troubling, I think, to some people. One big one is that you can do cost-benefit analysis in what I would call sort of the microeconomic approach. In other words, let's take a group that I deal with quite a bit, and I do a lot of work with them. It's the American Water Works Association, and they represent all of the water utilities in the United States, and they're dealing daily with one of the problems that Sunstein talks about, which is arsenic in drinking water. And if you look at the cost-benefit analyses that go on by the American Water Works Association, since they are utility representatives or a utility organization. Of course, what they do is they ask themselves, how much did it cost the utility to put in treatment methods for something like arsenic? And that then goes into one side of the column, and then in the other column goes something like the number of cancers that have been avoided by putting that treatment system in. And so the cost that's calculated there is microeconomic in the sense that it's the cost to that particular utility. What's not included in that column of costs is the fact that there is an industry that has grown up to build the treatment methods. And so it's not as if the, let's say you spent $1 million on your treatment system to get rid of arsenic, it's not as if $1 million has been poured down a drain somewhere and you've just lost it and you've got to compare that against the benefits from health effects. This $1 million shows up somewhere. It shows up in the pocket of someone who's built the treatment system, for example. So one of the big problems with cost-benefit analyses is trying to figure out which costs really belong in those things and trying to step back and take a what I would call a macroeconomic approach to it and sort of ask, where is this money coming from that's going into the environmental regulations, meeting the environmental regulations, and is this money really just disappearing from society? CBA basically assumes, I'm slightly overstating this, but it's really correct technically, basically assumes that money spent on environmental regulations is just gone from the economy. And of course, if you're the utilities, that's a legitimate viewpoint. The money is gone. You don't have that money sitting in your bank account anymore. But from the standpoint of society, that money's not gone. It's gone someplace else. So I think this is a real problem with one of the hidden assumptions of cost-benefit analysis is that it takes this really sort of neoclassical microeconomic approach to decision-making.
All right, let me ask you, too, if one more might be simply that cost-benefit analysis seems to want to reduce everything into dollars or whatever your local currency happens to be, so that you have to come up with a dollar amount for the death of an individual or for the cancer of an individual or for the prolonged illness of an individual or for the effects on the environment. That in order to have a cost-benefit analysis, you have to put everything in some kind of common currency, and that currency tends to be money.
Yeah. Well, there is a strong school of, I'll call it sort of the weak and the strong schools of cost-benefit analysis. There is a strong school that insists on that, that you take, for example, the dollars that you've just spent on arsenic for regulation, and then you take the number of health effects that you've saved, and you ask yourself, how many dollars are those health effects worth? And if it turns out that you've spent more dollars on the treatment method than you've gotten back in terms of dollars worth of health, then you don't go forward with the regulation. I don't see Sunstein falling into that camp. I think, given that he's coming out of philosophy and law, I think he's got a little more subtle view on cost-benefit analysis, which is to say that you do need the two columns. You need to know how many dollars have been spent, and you need to know how many cancers have you avoided and so forth. But I don't think there's anything inherent in his book which says that you have to go to the strong position and then reduce both of those columns to a common unit. I think he's very comfortable with the idea of saying, well, I spent a certain number of dollars on treating arsenic, and I saved, X thousands of people, and now let's just go and make a decision. I think his argument is that it's wrong to avoid those two calculations of costs and of benefits when you make a decision, but I don't think he is insisting in here that you go the full nine yards and reduce them both to dollar amounts. So I think that's a legitimate concern if somebody is reducing cost-benefit analysis down to a total amount spent on regulation minus the total amount of health that you've saved, but that's not inherent in cost-benefit analysis.
Okay. All right. Let's move to the second point, because we're about two-thirds of the way through the show now. You indicated that sometimes we really do just have troubles identifying what the cost and the benefits are. And I think your first answer at least indicates some of the reasons why that might be true, but I wonder if you'd amplify that a bit more.
I mean, the trouble with the cost has to do with whether you're taking a microeconomic or a macroeconomic approach to things. And I would say that those troubles that you have with identifying the cost occur whether you're working in a cost-benefit analysis approach or an approach that we might look at the end of the discussion here on the way in which regulations currently are set. So I don't find that problem necessarily to be unique to cost-benefit analysis. On the risk side, there are problems of trying to sort of quantify the risk, given that risk is a multidimensional thing. I mean, I can talk about the probability that an individual gets an effect. I can talk about the fact that different individuals are going to have different probabilities of effect because some of them smoke, for example, and that makes them more sensitive. Some of them live closer to a facility, and so that makes them more highly exposed, and so on. So there's this problem of the distribution of risks. There's this problem of the uncertainty in the risk estimate and how you're going to reflect uncertainty in it. There's a problem associated with the fact that there are lots of different kinds of effects that we might consider, all the way from relatively minor changes in the bloodstream, the blood chemistry, up to somebody dropping over dead from a fatal tumor, and trying to capture that complexity of risk in any sort of measure is difficult. But and in fact, I would say it's impossible. But and Sunstein, though, I think he's equivocal on that point. If he's going to be driven towards the strict cost-benefit analysis approach where you have to reduce benefits down to a single number, then he'll have all those problems that I just mentioned. But I think, again, that he might be comfortable with the idea of the fact that you do have to take into account probabilities. You do have to take into account the severity of different effects and so on, and that in the end it might simply be a judgment that somebody has to come to as to how those things balance themselves out. Although there's a strain in his book that, because he's giving relatively simple examples, there's a strain in his book that says, boy, you're always going to be able to come up with a single number for the benefits in society. And so I think he could stumble over that problem if he were to look at a little more closely at the sort of multidimensional nature of risk.
All right, let's move on to the third one, where you begin to talk about different ways in which people might even conceive of or understand risk. And you specifically reject the subjective conception of risk. Risk is what I think is risky. But I wonder if you could say more about the psychologistic view of risk, which you think at least has some appeal and might at least be an alternative way of thinking about risk rather than the one developed by Sunstein.
Yeah, Sunstein comes out of a school, again, I'll call it the objective school, that says, let's take something like the probability that somebody is going to get sick from some disease. And our risk analyst comes back and says, my best estimate of that is 1 in 1,000,000. You've got 1 in 1,000,000 chance of developing a cancer or something. And the objective school thinks that, now that's the risk. I might be uncertain about it, but that's the risk, this 1 in 1,000,000 number. And so they would talk about the risk, and they would talk about the uncertainty in the risk. The psychologistic school says, risk does have something to do with probabilities, but it also has something to do with uncertainties. We risk something because we're uncertain whether it will happen. Now, the objective school finds that really odd. They think that we're confusing probability of effect with our confidence in the estimate of that probability. But the psychologistic school says no, they're those two ideas, probability and confidence, are mixed together. And so what the psychologistic school is looking for is a measure of risk that reflects both the probability that somebody gets the effect and our uncertainty about that estimate of the probability. And cost-benefit analysis just can't deal with that issue. It's accustomed to thinking of the actual outcome of a policy as being a number of deaths, a number of savings of death, a number of savings of health effects and so forth. And then superimposed onto that estimate of the number of health effects is this judgment about the uncertainty in that estimate. And, the psychologistic school says, no, the uncertainty in the estimate and the number of effects are both part of the idea of risk. Now, having said that, the practical implications of those two schools is a little difficult to tease out. Certainly in a half hour here, it's difficult to tease out. But let's just say that the main difference is that if you're in the objective school, it tends to drive you towards using your best estimate of the probability of cancer. And in the case of the psychologistic school, it tends to drive you towards using a sort of upper bound estimate. You would say, I'm 95% confident that the real number of cancers that will happen is below a certain value. So the objective school tends to go with the average estimate of the risk, and the psychologistic school tends to go with some sort of upper bound estimate. And so the psychologistic school tends to drive you towards what I might call a sort of precautionary approach in regulation.
You do have a couple more objections, which you mentioned, but we only have a couple of minutes left. And I'm wondering if it might be more helpful for the listener if you could try to briefly say how you think we ought to approach issues of regulating risks, perhaps in light of Sunstein's book.
First, I have to say, I spent a lot of time in Europe, living in Salzburg in Austria, and over there, we don't get into these discussions over cost-benefit analysis and so forth, because we tend to make decisions in Europe based on groups of people getting together and just reflecting on information. Here in the United States, we have this whole formal quantitative approach to making decisions. We have formal risk assessment and formal cost-benefit analysis and so forth. And so we get driven into these debates about whether cost-benefit analysis is the correct approach and what variant of cost-benefit analysis. So I have to say that sort of emotionally, I prefer the European approach, which says, well, let's take a look at what the cost-benefit says. Let's take a look at some other principles that I'll talk about in just a moment. But in the end, it really is just a human judgment, and let's not pretend that we can, you know, have a calculus that's going to tell us what level we should regulate arsenic at. But I'll say first, I think cost-benefit analysis is needed despite its limitations, and we haven't done anywhere near enough of that in the United States. We've hidden from it, and it's gotten us into a position where we do spend disproportionate amounts of money, and I think Sunstein is right. It has failed to decrease by the amount possible the human suffering, and so we need CBA. I think there's not, however, a finite pool of money. One of the big assumptions of CBA is there is a finite pool of money to spend on regulation, and we have to allocate it. And so I think that any regulation needs to take into account the fact that the pool of money is not finite, and that some people are simply going to at times have to bear the cost of a regulation because they're using a common resource. They're using our air and water and so forth. And I don't think any cost-benefit analysis should be a trump card to keep them from having to pay into some common pool to pay for the fact that they're imposing risks on people. Where probabilities have got to be estimated, where risks have got to be estimated, I think it's perfectly rational to use experts, and I think Sunstein's absolutely right on that. And I also worry about the extent to which political and social currents can drive risk calculations in the United States. So I think we do need to continue to buffer our policymakers from potentially poorer estimates of the overall risk. But I think that we have to formulate the regulations slightly differently than Sunstein does. I'm more interested in regulations that say, by doing the following thing, by regulating arsenic, I'm protecting a reasonable fraction of the population against an unreasonable risk, but I'm doing it in a way which is cost effective. So there's nothing in Sunstein's argument, nothing within cost-benefit analysis, that talks about what fraction of the population am I protecting against an unreasonable level of risk. And the reason for that is, the reason that CBA doesn't incorporate that is, it's utilitarian. It looks at the entire sum of human suffering in the world and doesn't ask about how that's distributed, although Sunstein does give you some possible options for dealing with that. So I like the idea of staying where we're going right now, using the existing regulatory framework, buffering our decision makers a little bit from public currents, giving them greater access to expert resources, but also forcing them to at least have the cost-benefit analysis information on the table. We do need to know what the costs of these regulations are.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Okay. I've been
speaking today with Douglas Crawford Brown, Director of the Carolina Environmental Program at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is Hugh LaFontaine, Fridays and Issues. Good day.